Hey there, folks. This is Screen Watching. My name's Dan, joined by Simon. Simon, I know you're a murderer. I'm not going to call the police. I'm not going to call the feds. Just know there's only one thing I ask of you. You and I, we're going to start recording a true crime podcast together.
This is not like TV only battle.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What? That's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
People, folks, dudes, dudettes, my fellow countrymen, my name is Dan Barrett. I'm joined by Simon Foster for the Screen Watching Podcast. It is the podcast that all the kids are talking about on the streets. They're like, folks, you got to pay attention to this podcast. They talk about the movies they've watched. They talk about the TV shows they've experienced. They talk about the video games that they've conceptually heard of on the streets at some point. This is the podcast you got to listen to. That's what the kids are saying on the street.
This is what the kids are saying. Hello, Dan Barrett. Hello, Screen Watchers everywhere. I know you meant that in a mocking tone, but I was at the opening of the Sydney Film Festival just the other night, and I'll be referring to that in my review of The New Boy later. But I met two lovely film producers, Maren and Rebecca, who recognized me from the Screen Watching podcast, from my luscious tones, my dulcet voice, as they described it in my imagination. And it was lovely to be recognized for the podcast. So I think we're making an impact.
So I presume that it came about because you saw some women walk towards you and then you made eye contact and they just ran away, like just really fast out of the building, chase them down the street. I'm assuming that's how it played out.
That's exactly what happened. Yes. No, it's a, it was lovely to be recognized for our podcast efforts. But you've been well. Now, you did mention at the top of the podcast that we are going to dabble in the world of gaming in this introduction, because I made the point that Diablo 4 out there, which is doing gangbusters on the side of buses all over Sydney and the world, and you said, oh, it's nothing compared to Zelda, which got us thinking, what is a blockbuster game and how does it relate to the world of blockbusters in film and television? I wasn't sure how it all rang out, but you seem to have a fairly clear perspective on it.
I mean, quite clearly, it's just that you're in a bit of a bubble, and I don't think you quite realize that even the biggest movie release of the year are shit compared to most video game releases, like the big ones, because like the things probably keep in mind, like the really interesting comp this year is you compare Super Mario Brothers, the movie, which came out and we know it passed $1 billion. It's doing remarkably well. It's one of the all-time
hitting upwards of 1.4, I think,
animated last films.
Yeah, huge.
Like, yeah, doing gangbusters. But then you compare that to, say, the Legend of Zelda game, also by Nintendo, that came out, about a month after the Mario movie hit cinema screens. They passed 10 million copies in the first 3 days. Think about the fact that every copy of Zelda costs about, like, $50-$60. So, you know, they're raking in the cash. That's just the first 3 days. That is a title that they will continue to sell at fairly high volumes for the rest of the year, if not going further in. Like the first Zelda game.
That's
is
amazing.
Like an absolute blockbuster.
Yeah, and it's an ongoing brand, obviously. It's an ongoing franchise for them, so there's that behind it, but it doesn't seem to be weakening. Unlike movies and to a certain extent TV shows, where sequels are exponentially weaker commercially or often critically than the original product, there seems to be this loyalty to this brand loyalty amongst gamers, which is quite extraordinary. Which is why the fourth Diablo or the umpteenth Zelda or whatever all the other ones are, you can tell I'm a real gamer, are so profitable. Plus, they can roll out everywhere instantly. There's no borders that they can't cross. There's no language barriers that can't be broken down instantly. So they've got the distribution model in place to make them instantly, you know, cash rich.
Indeed. Anyway, we could talk about this all evening in such, you know, great detail, because both of us are completely...
No, we couldn't. That's literally about all I know about it. That's...
Look, I mean, if I was going to drop one more thing in, I could talk about the fact that apparently Universal and Nintendo are in, like, close to final talks on the Zelda movie that will be inevitably hitting cinema screens because Mario did so well for them.
Oh, for sure. They can just write their own passage now, those people. All right. So what are we reviewing tonight? We've got lots to talk about.
Look, we do have a fair bit to get onto here. So we are, here's what's on my docket. I'm going to talk about the new HBO, I guess we can call it a drama. The Scandalous, The Idol. I'll be discussing that. And I'll also be discussing a series that launched on Peacock in the US. It's called Based on a True Story, and it is about two everyday people living in suburbia, just dealing with the stuff that happens in suburbia. It's keeping your job. It's having that first child sort of later in life. Oh, it's so much going on, except suddenly they encounter a person who quite possibly may be a serial killer, and they do that one thing you do, which is they start a true crime podcast with them.
Ooh, I'm keen to see how this differs from A, Our Lives, as you alluded to at the top of the show, and B, the Steve Martin, Selena Gomez, Martin Short, Only Murders in the Building, which is also along the similar lines. That's interesting. All right, well, I'm keen to talk about that. I'll be talking about the opening night film of the Sydney Film Festival, The New Boy, the new film from Warwick Thornton starring Cate Blanchett, and a little film that has crept into cinemas with absolutely no fanfare or marketing behind it at all, called To Catch a Killer, with our own Ben Mendelsohn involved and the lovely Shailene Woodley. And I've got a few choice words to say about that.
It stinks.
Simon, let's delve into the reviews. Do you want to kick things off with, what's the first movie you want to discuss here?
I'm going to discuss the new Warwick Thornton film called The New Boy.
To the Aboriginal protector, Mr. Crank. I am writing regarding the progress of the new boy you sent us.
At the opening night of the Sydney Film Festival, just last Wednesday as we record this, Warwick Thornton presented with his young cast his new film, The New Boy, straight from the Cannes Film Festival to the State Theatre here in Sydney. This is the story of a young Indigenous boy, a 9-year-old orphan, played by, I do want to get his name right, I think it's Aswan Reed. He is dropped at a remote orphanage where Sister Eileen, played by Cate Blanchett, oversees the very small group of young children alongside George, the groundskeeper, played by Wayne Blair, and a fellow sister, Deborah Mailman, who plays Sister Mum. Both George and Sister Mum are of Indigenous origins. Cate Blanchett is the whitest of white women overseeing them all. She has taken control after Dom Peter, the priest who ran the orphanage, passed away a year ago, and no replacement, it says, has been sent. And she is very much under the stresses of running this orphanage, and she's using alcohol to get through it. Now, the story here takes some unusual twist because Aswan Reed's character, who's only referred to as the new boy in the film, develops, has what can only be described as a certain magical realism about himself. He can rub his fingers together and conjure a small glowing flame that is able to heal the unwell and the damaged around him, much in the same way that Philip Clark Duncan's character did in The Green Mile. And there are moments in this film which certainly recall that. But with Warwick Thornton directing, you know this is going to be a hidden undercurrent, a hidden message that discusses the Indigenous people's culture and place in this world under white rule, and that is certainly the case with The New Boy. It doesn't do that quite so successfully as he's done with previous films. This, at times, is an extraordinarily beautiful film. It's stunning to look at. It's all shot in the South Australian outback. And Aswan Reed, as the young boy, is very good. But the moments of magical realism tend to sort of hang in the air a little bit, pardon the pun, and don't really connect in a way that drives the message home in as powerful a way as it could. In fact, some of it's pretty heavy-handed, and there's not enough sort of meat on the bones there to make it a really potent, powerful message that I would like to think he was aiming for. Blanchett is fine. There were some reviews out of the Cannes screening that she had you know, almost derails the film with some of her really big acting, which she's capable of doing. But I didn't find that to be the case at all. I found her to be a really sort of powerful screen presence, doing some of her best work. I've been thinking a lot about this film and wondering why it didn't connect with me, because it did find some fans after the screening, but I did have a lot of conversations afterwards with people saying, yeah, it's good and I admired it, but I can't say I really liked it, and all those sort of reactions. So it'll be keen to see what people think. We're actually getting a bit of a jump here. It goes into cinemas on July 6th. So you're hearing our review here first. And I know there's a couple of more screenings at Sydney cinemas in the weeks ahead as part of the festival. So do get out, do have discussions about this film. It is a movie that inspires sort of different perspectives and different takes on how Indigenous culture and white rule came upon the land here in Australia. And in that regard, there's plenty of discussions to be had. I just wish it had been a better source material. It's called The New Boy, in cinemas July 6th and playing at the Sydney Film Festival over the next couple of weeks.
Let's move on. Let's talk about a little television program. It debuted at the Cannes Film Festival inexplicably. I don't really understand why they did that, and it just proved just a bizarre choice all around. It's a new HBO drama of sorts. It's called The Idol.
You're the American dream. Rags to riches. Trailers to mansions. You are fucking Jocelyn.
Just be you.
Easy. I'll just do that.
How to describe The Idol? What do you talk about? I guess maybe you start with the fact the series was created by Sam Levinson. He's a fairly big deal these days in the world of the HBO dramas. Thanks for creating the youth drama called Euphoria. He's pretty much a one-man sort of writing, directing talent who's behind that program. He's teamed up here with Abel The Weeknd, Tesfaye, who is a very popular recording artist. To be honest, I don't think I can tell you a single Weeknd song, but that says a lot more about me than it says about him and his fame. He is a very big deal these days. Anyway, he is the person that stars in the series. Sam Levinson's behind the camera and doing a bit of co-writing as well. The premise of the series is you've got a pop idol played by Lily Rose Depp. That would be the daughter of one Johnny Depp. So, you know, Nepo baby leading the series here. She's a big deal pop star who's had some mental issues recently. Mother's died. She spent some time in a seeking some help. As the series opens, there is a photo shoot that's taking place. She's taking photos of what will be the cover for her album, as well as some other PR photos that will accompany the launch of this new album. She's doing this while... how does one describe this? She's very naked, I guess, would probably be the way to really describe this.
Yeah, there's a lot of nudity, nakedity.
It's very scant. So she's recording this and she's really engaged in this. Now, while she is fairly scant, there is an intimacy coordinator who's on the set. He's saying, look, you can't do this. We need to have a 48-hour break in between. We need to have her sign off saying that she's okay with that. And then we can return after 48 hours and be okay to continue this as based on the stipulations in her contract. She's like, no, I'm cool to keep on doing this. And he's like, no, can't do it. So he gets locked in a broom closet by the Simpsons.
Hank Azaria.
Yep.
Who still can't leave behind his accent, but you know.
Exactly. But apparently this one's okay because he's Jewish as well. So it's all fine. So you've got this taking place. And while she's taking all these photos and there's all this stuff going on with the intimacy coordinator, news is broken that a photo has appeared on the internet of this pop star. And she is in this photo. And I'm trying to work out, because there's a family audience for this podcast. So how do you describe this entirely? I believe that in the photograph, she is depicted as having jizz all over her face.
Yes, that's exactly how it's depicted. And you do get to see the photograph at one point, which was quite shocking.
Yeah, it's shocking-ish. So You've got this going on. Now, what I've just described here is the first like 25, 30 minutes of the opening episode. And I will say, all of that, I was riveted. I was completely into this. This opened up feeling like it was like an Altman behind the scenes of like a production in Hollywood. You've got the layered voices over the top. Like, it felt like an Altman movie, but with some really salacious stuff going in there. It was edgy. It was really just popping all over the place. But then the series cuts to her going out to a nightclub later that night just to, you know, get over the hellish day that she's had and just to, you know, get some ghetto dance on. And this is where The Weeknd ends up becoming a character in the TV show. As soon as that character makes his entrance in, and just, I think it's really worth just noting, as a screen presence, he has none. Like, he is a absolute vortex of screen charisma in every possible way. As soon as he comes into the show, like, the entire series is just unwatchable from that point in. It went from being so lively, so exciting to watch, and just it felt like an absolute breath of fresh air. I was like, this is an incredible TV show. I'm into this in a really big way I hadn't expected. And then suddenly he's there. He plays the character as the DJ at this club. He's spinning some Madonna tracks, but apparently he's also a cult leader, as we find out in future episodes. There's a very awkwardly shoehorned in conversation about the movie Basic Instinct, which many people are looking at as being a bit of a series tipping its hat to where the series is going. So expect a murder, expect some lesbian shenanigans, who knows what's going to take place. But all I know is I probably won't be there to see it because I saw the second half of this episode and I just can't come back for it. I can't do it. But if I'm going to say one nice thing about it from this point in, I will say the show has really nicely cast Rachel Sennett. Rachel Sennett, you know, I think many of us had a awakening to after she was in my favorite movie of 2 years ago now, Simon. What even was that? When did that film come out? You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Shiva Baby. Absolutely. Yeah. She was wonderful.
Yeah. So Shiva Baby, there was that thing about the Jewish family sitting Shiva. She has come, she's like a friend of the family, so, you know, extended family. And she's in there, and so lots of people are interested in her and her relationship with her ex-girlfriend, which is kind of bubbling on the side. It doesn't matter. Shiva Baby, amazing movie. The Idol, not so much. That's my review.
Great film. All right, so I don't disagree with a lot of that. This opening segment of the first sort of shots fired in this episode of The Idol, I found fascinating. You're right, and I know it's not really cool to say so anymore, but I found the banter and the frankness and the bitterness and the insider sort of takes that people like Eli Roth and Jane Addams and Hank Azaria all sort of bring to those opening scenes as being reminiscent of the best of Entourage. I thought there were certainly some elements of that in there as well. And she's certainly compelling to look at, and she's quite compelling as an actress, Lily Rose Depp. And she's asked to do some extraordinarily physical things in this episode, not just sexually, but the dance moves and the frankness with her own body and those sort of things. So bravo to her for pulling off this character. I got confused when I was told that the internet blew up with this photo of her with the aforementioned jizz on her face could ruin her career, but then she went clubbing and nobody seemed to talk about it and seemed to mention it. And I got into a discussion with my partner, with my wife watching it, saying, and I thought, was this a flashback? Because nobody at all seems to be referencing this thing that is going to send her career off the rails. So when The Weeknd, who is every bit the talent vacuum as an actor that you describe, it's just painful to watch some of the scenes he has with her when they get back to the apartment. I started to realize very early on that this wasn't trying to do anything too profound or anything too important. And I think the references to Basic Instinct and some of the coverage of it, which sort of mentioned Showgirls, give some idea of the heightened trash that this really is, which doesn't make it any less enjoyable. If it's done well with a smart script, I think that's going to work for me. So I'm sort of in for the haul at this stage, but it's walking a very fine line between trash that I can treasure and just trash that is trash. So we'll see how the episodes unfold going forward.
Look, I'm very okay with trash, but yeah, like it has to be engaging, entertaining trash, and this certainly didn't feel like that for the back half of it. And the rest of the series is going to be more of that back half than it is that first half. So that's worth keeping in mind. Also worth just noting is that you mentioned there's a bit of a sort of hat tip to Showgirls. Elizabeth Berkley, the star of both Showgirls and Saved by the Bell, and also Saved by the Bell, The Next Generation. Was that what it was called? The recent Next Saved by the Bell. But anyway, she appears in this, and it's probably also just worth talking about the fact there is like this really amazing supporting cast that are visible in this. So you've got Elizabeth Berkley in there. Anne H. makes an appearance. This is her final role, final screen role. Obviously, there was that car accident a little while ago. Hank Azaria is in there. Eli Roth is in there, and he's hilarious in this. Dan Levy from Schitt's Creek is in this. Devoyne Joe Randolph, who is probably best known for the High Fidelity TV show, but she was a cop, I think, in Murder, Only Murders in the Building. Was that where I saw her recently?
Okay, yep.
She was a cop in something I was watching. I feel it was that. Rachel Sennett, as I mentioned. And Jane Addams is absolutely hilarious as a publicist who has led a pretty wild life in the past and is more than happy to talking about it with everyone in some fairly explicit details. At one point, she refers to, and I'm going to paraphrase here, being made love to in the behind in a stairwell. Great television. Really love that first half hour.
She has some great lines. Yeah. And it's great to see her play that kind of character, because she was, through the 90s, she was kind of this sort of wallflower type of indie drama queen who was always, I remember most vividly in the Todd Solondz film Happiness, where she was a very mopey face sort of 90s ingenue. And she's, with this one, she's got a really tart mouth and a really strong presence on screen. So, yeah, it's great to see her in this. I think there's enough pluses in that first episode, and I haven't seen any more than the first episode, to weigh out the minuses, as big as a couple of those minuses are. So, yeah, I'm excited for where it's going to go.
I believe that this is what's referred to as a troubled production. And I think the reason why you'll find that nobody talked about the nightclub, nobody talked about the photo at the nightclub, is because all that was shot before they filmed the final sequence, which was probably the first sequence that we saw there. So I suspect that that's kind of where that distress aspect comes from.
All right, that makes a lot more sense.
Also, I've got an apology I need to make.
It's a very strange, in terms...
Sorry, Simon, I've got an apology I need to make. Let me get through this. Yeah. It's not easy.
Yeah.
I think it was last week, maybe the week before, we had a segment on this program where we were talking about depictions of self-gratification on screen. And you're probably wondering right now, where am I going with this?
Yes.
Where I am going with this is there was an omission that got made during that entire segment, which is the final 35 seconds of the movie Happiness. We did not discuss that during that segment, and I've been regretting it for the last like week or two, however long it's been. It's been weighing heavily on me. So I just like to say that, yes, we definitely should have talked about the final moments of Happiness when we talked about self-gratification on screen. Simon.
Yes. Yes, we should have. What was I going to say? Oh, yes. A bit of a sidetrack to what The Idol means to HBO and the launch of Max. There's been a lot of rumblings that this was the big audience-grabbing follow-up that was going to fill the void that Succession was leaving with its ending. Is that just by coincidence because they were ready to go with this and they decided to end Succession when they did? Or was there a real belief that this has the sort of water cooler buzz about it that Succession ultimately developed into? I can't see any of the same audience coming back for The Idol that were hooked to the Succession, or vice versa.
Look, I don't know who's filling your mind with these sorts of things. The thing to keep in mind is HBO are looking at this as a way to keep that youth audience that came in for Euphoria. So HBO as a brand skews much older. The audience for HBO is very much you and not young, just vibrant young people like myself. No, that's not true at all. Basically, the audience for HBO is you and I. The audience that they are trying to court as they're trying to bring more people onto Max are people who are in their teens, are people in their early 20s, going into their 30s. Euphoria captured that in a way that HBO just generally doesn't really quite hit that point. This was very much driven around the idea of, hey, we've got people from Euphoria involved. We've got The Weeknd, who's very big with the kids. Let's do a show. It hasn't really worked out for them. They did that launch at Cannes, which was critically derided. Audiences didn't respond. The critics just lambasted it entirely. And then the show debuted to under a million people for that first episode. So, you know.
Wow. Okay.
Is what it is. Yeah.
Good luck with that. Okay, that's The Idol. It is on HBO for our international viewers and listeners, and binge here in the Oz. I got to the movies, despite the distributor of Roadshow Films doing their darndest to keep me away from this film. I got to the cinema and saw To Catch a Killer.
We have an Olympic class marksman running wild.
Every shot found its mark. 305 West at the end. No casings, no brass. Not a single fingerprint.
Start recording. Every face on video. Get them on your phone.
We open on Baltimore on New Year's Eve in the middle of a large fireworks display, as only the Baltimoreans can do. We jump from party to party and rooftop to rooftop and glass lift to glass lift, just in time to see all manner of people being picked off by a killer, a sniper who's working from an apartment in the center of the city and is able to see 29 people that he, with a single bullet, is able to kill. Not with a single bullet, of course, with 29 different bullets, but is a marksman to the extent that he's able to do this. Called to the scene right when it starts to unfold is a young police officer played by Shailene Woodley, and she runs to the building where the shots are fired from. This takes place over about the first 10 or 15 minutes of the film. And I've got to say, and I think I put this on Twitter or something, or Facebook, because I'm old, this is the best first 10 minutes of a movie I've seen this year. It is so exciting to watch and so sort of gut-wrenching to see who might be the next victim and whether she'll get there in time. And it's filmed in such a way that is both sort of edgy 70s cop sort of action, but also really riveting sort of up-to-date action filmmaking as well, all in the driving Baltimore snow and all with the police all slowly realizing that these terrible shootings are going on. It's a terrific opening to a film. What then unfolds is a police procedural star that features Ben Mendelsohn as an FBI agent who's brought in and who recognizes something special in Shailene Woodley's character, a mind that is both damaged and totally in tune with the job she has to do to try to track this killer down. And they become, with a couple of other people, the task force that is given the job of finding the killer, which is the really exciting police procedural side of it, and that works a treat. There's also a classic sort of local politician who's trying to get his face in front of the media and trying to bring a killer to justice when there's really no leads to work with. There's also some pretty sick sort of serial killer stuff that starts to be revealed as the movie goes along. And on top of that, you've got this terrific character interplay between Shailene Woodley and Ben Mendelsohn, who are fantastic on screen. And when it's revealed that he's this very tough-talking FBI agent, but also a married gay man, and the tensions and the sort of overlapping themes that that brings to this movie, I just found to be one of the most compelling stories and one of the most fascinating and exciting films I've seen in the cinema in a long, long time. Now, a quick sidetrack here. This is from Roadshow Films, who about 18 months ago, maybe a bit longer, lost the Warner Brothers library to Universal here in Australia. Sorry to get all industry on this, but this means that Roadshow have very little to release. They've got a deal with the Film Nation Abu Dhabi organization, and they've sent them things like Mafia Mama and this film, To Catch a Killer, and they're riding on films like Blueback and the sequel to The Dry, which is coming out in August, to make any sort of money here in Australia. So Roadshow Films have put no money behind the promotion of this film and have really just dumped it into a handful of cinemas, which is a terrible, terrible shame, because this is exactly the sort of movie, Dan, that you and I talk about as being the sort of things that were reliable, sturdy bits of Hollywood entertainment that we used to be able to see at the cinema fairly regularly, but we don't anymore. This has sort of elements of Sidney Lumet in the way it tells a story. I was reminded a little bit of Internal Affairs, the Richard Gere, Andy Garcia film from back in the day. So if you can get out and see this, I've got a terrible feeling that most people are going to see this on a streaming platform, but it deserves to be seen on the big screen, and it tells a cracking tale as well. It's called To Catch a Killer. It's in kind of wide release, not very very wide, but it's out there.
Yeah, look, I'm curious about seeing this. It wasn't on my radar at all. Your enthusiasm's got me interested, but at the same time, I'm also looking at that Rotten Tomatoes score, which is quite limited, and I'm burned a little bit by you saying that movie last week about masturbating on Netflix was really quite good when it was really quite terrible. So I don't know what to believe anymore, Simon. I don't know what to believe.
Trust me on this one. We'll let the Swedish masturbating movie slide for now, but do trust me on To Catch a Killer.
Yeah, I'm just not sure what to believe. I'm just going to move on to the next review, which is a TV program. It's called Based on a True Story.
Now, who's ready to talk murder?
Do we have to wake up to murders every morning?
They're talking about the serial killer that's like basically in our backyard. It is so exciting.
So, Simon, a couple of years ago, there was that TV series. It was an HBO Max launch title. It was called The Flight Attendant. This was a series that starred former Big Bang Theory star Kaley Cuoco. We'll get there eventually. I'm sure none of those was right. Anyway, she starred in A Flight Attendant. It was a big success, and for some reason they decided to do A Flight Attendant 2, and then that disappeared, and nobody really ever spoke about that season, and there was never any word of follow-up shows. Now, when I saw that, like when I saw the first season, I was like, well, why would you go on to do a second season? Like, this is like a done it, like one and done. Like, that's kind of what the value of a show like this should be. So it's actually kind of nice to see Kaley Cuoco pop up in another TV program not soon after. It's this thing called Based on a True Story. I think she's genuinely a really charismatic TV presence. And I feel that she was maybe a little bit wasted on the 34 seasons worth of Big Bang Theory that they did. And was certainly wasting her time with that second season of Flight Attendant. But she's here kind of doing exactly what she should be doing, which is she's a very grounded, like just engaging screen presence in this. She's one half of a couple. It's her and Chris Messina, who, I mean, he's the opposite of The Weeknd. The Weeknd is a charisma vacuum. This guy is all charisma. I'm a big fan of the Chris Messina.
Yeah,
seen most recently in Air with his very Eli Gold sort of level swearing, shouty agent.
Sweary sports agent. Yeah, he was great.
Yeah. So anyway, Kaylee and Chris, I don't quite know what her background's supposed to be. Like, she's a real estate agent at the moment. Apparently, she's been doing it for about 5 years. They're expecting their first child, and he's a former tennis great who spent the last 17 years working for a local resorts club. Teaching, you know, the members of the club how to play tennis. And he's been very popular, except in recent sort of months, his popularity has been usurped by like a young, attractive tennis pro that they've brought into also work there. Anyway, pretty much he's fired more or less at the beginning of the show. He's not quite fired. He's told that he's no longer going to be like the head tennis coach and instead will be just teaching the kids, which is effectively a fire.
That's gonna hurt.
Yeah, very much so. So he's questioning where he is in life. Yeah, he's questioning where he is. Both of them are very sort of financially concerned at the moment because he's clearly lost his well-paying job. Their plumbing system at home, their toilet suddenly starts bringing leaks. And so they call in a plumber. And this is where it all goes awry. Excuse me one second.
Okay.
It all goes awry. This plumber enters their life. Nathan ends up becoming still fairly good friends with this guy, Matt. Matt is a tennis enthusiast who, because Nathan and Ava can't really quite afford to pay for the plumbing, they strike a deal where this guy will do the plumbing for them. In exchange, he'll do a few free tennis like lessons. But they go out to a bar. Nathan has a bit of a friendly chat with the girl working behind the bar, played by Natalia Dyer, who people would know from Stranger Things. I can't think of the character's name.
I love Natalia. She's great.
But people know who she is, I think. I always think she's a bit weird looking. Like, I don't know. She didn't start out weird looking in Stranger Things, but increasingly she seems to have gotten weirder looking as that show's gone on. But that's a side tangent.
She would have been the girl I had a crush on in high school, I think. She had that sort of look to her. She seemed very nice.
don't know. She seems like the kind of girl that you have a crush on now, Simon. But that's, again, neither here nor there.
That's true, actually.
Yeah.
I know. That's a bit weird. I'm going to cop flak for that. But anyway, you know
little
what I
mean. Bit. It's fine. Your wife doesn't listen to this, I'm sure.
Not at all.
Yeah, exactly. Look, so Nathan starts having a bit of a chat with her behind the bar. He kind of thinks that she's got a bit of a thing for him, where clearly she just doesn't. But as we know from the opening seconds of this program, there is a true crime involved, and it was her getting a bit of stabby. Who was the murderer? And, you know, we kind of all know where it's going. And the entire premise of the series is really set up on the idea that Ava is a true crime podcast enthusiast. Suddenly, this guy Matt, who's a bit stabby and has quite likely done a bit of the old murder, he's entered their life. And so instead of going to the police with the understanding that he's gone and killed Chloe, the Natalia Dyer character, instead of going to the police, they say to him, hey, look, how about we host a true crime podcast together and we've got to make some money off this thing. So it's their money-making venture.
Interesting premise.
Now, the question you had that you threw out there earlier was, what makes this different to Only Murders in the Building? And what the difference is this. Both of them are ostensibly comedies. Only Murders in the Building is a funnier program generally. It's built to be more of a comedy, whereas this is very much a sort of wry comedy, sort of satire of, you know, true crime podcast obsessives.
Mm-hmm.
They use the podcast in Only Murders in the Building as just a vehicle to get things going. Here, I think it's actually a bit more just integral to the spirit of intent of what they're talking about here. It's about people who are living lives that are maybe sort of slightly less fulfilling than the ideal would have liked. And so, I mean, the AV character particularly is investing a lot of her time in the true crime podcast. And so it's just a bit more part of the DNA of the program, where it seems to be more of an aside in Only Murders in the Building. Plus also that's very much a whodunit, whereas this starts very much from the idea that we kind of know who did it. It's really about what happens next as they start sort of playing around with the podcast format.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, that's good to know, because I'm a big Kaley Cuoco fan, and I think that if we lived in a time when there were movie stars, she would have had her Pretty Woman or her While You Were Sleeping by Now and had a big or her Sleepless in Seattle and been a big movie star already. But we don't do that anymore. So I think she's about as popular as she's ever going to get. But yeah, I think she's great.
Look, I don't think that's true. I think the comp is probably more someone like Jennifer Aniston. So, you know, coming from TV, doing quite well in that, and then dovetailing a career onto the big screen after there.
Yeah.
But anyway,
yeah, I think
based on a true story, I really quite liked it. I expected nothing from this program at all, outside of the fact I kind of liked the cast in it. But I was really into this first episode. I'll see it through for the season because I think it's a good one.
Good to know. Hey, that brings to the end of our review segment, which it's time for the intermission.
Simon, this week's intermission comes from me sitting down during the week to watch there's a four-part documentary series which has been timed to release with Warner Brothers' 100th anniversary of releasing movies, and the documentary series is called 100 Years of Warner Brothers. How do they come up with these titles?
Like a stretch?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Wild. But anyway, what this does is every episode, it's like a series of hour-long programs, and they just sort of contextualize the history and iconic nature of Warner Brothers through just various elements. So the very first one is looking at the origins of the studio through the Brothers Warner and the sorts of films that they're making sort of early in the studio's history.
Yeah. And what defined them as a studio and the films that were the point of difference with the rest of a blossoming Hollywood.
This is not exactly a deep investigative documentary by any means. It's have you seen it?
I've seen that first episode, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I've only watched the first one as well at this point. I'll watch the rest. I thought it was quite good for what it is, but it's one of these things that's very much in part corporate video. But then also, I mean, it's kind of like a APK, that's not quite right. One of those press kits that you'd find on like a DVD set back in the day.
Oh, the EPK sort of EPK. At the back end. Yeah, yeah. It really is. And they get the big stars out to do a good one for Warner Brothers. They get the George Clooney's and the Keanu Reeves out there to speak highly of the people who pay them to speak highly. And they do a good job of it. It's great seeing the old footage and learning the history to Morgan Freeman's dulcet tones about, you know, them going there from their poor beginnings, and not George and Keanu, I mean the Warner Brothers.
Mm, and their sister Dot. But the sister Dot's not a real thing. That's just in that cartoon that's program. Not,
yeah. You made that up.
It's from Animaniacs.
So the point we're coming to is that after 100 years of Warner Brothers, there's an awful lot of content to choose from. In fact, if I did my job, they have 145,000 hours of programming, including 12,500 feature films and 2,400 television programs comprising more than tens of thousands. That's a terrible sentence. Comprising more than tens of thousands of individual episodes. So of all the Warner Brothers stuff that's gone before, and it's a century of it, we're going to pick out our favorite Warner Brothers properties. I'm sort of a film focused. You're a bit film and TV. Why don't you go first? Because I want to hear what you've got to say, because I'm going to talk for hours on this.
Look, I'd rather not talk for hours on this because, you know, let's be honest, we're pretty far into this podcast.
You haven't done your research. Simon,
and I haven't done my research.
Yeah.
What I'll say, what I quite like about the origins of Warner Brothers, and to me, this kind of really sort of carries through to like the entire history of Warner since then, and they talk about this in that first hour of the documentary, is that in the very sort of early era of Warner Brothers, you had a whole bunch of studios like MGM, for example, which had a lot of very prestigious movies that were being released. But as the Great Depression was hitting, just, you know, pre-war, you've got Warner Brothers that went out there and they were really making movies for the people. So they were like just good quality, just like crime pictures, and were really doing what they could just to connect in with like your average, you know, cinema attendee. And I quite like that about Warner Brothers. So I always look at Warner Brothers as a brand, which have just consistently sort of high quality, just like meaty, substantial movies that actually do speak to the spirit of movie making. But also they are very commercial properties. And I really like that tone. When I see the Warner Brothers logo on screen, I kind of know that I'm up for something good. And whether that's sort of through like sort of the 70s, where there's sort of those more worthy pictures, like say like All the President's Men, which starts with the great classic 1970s Warner Brothers logo. I'm trying to work out how I can actually describe that logo, because that's probably my favorite incarnation of Warner's logo.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got that, but then it sort of carries that through in the 80s, and there's all these great sort of Clint Eastwood movies, like that movie where he's sleeping with a whole bunch of prostitutes. Can't think of the name of the movie. I want to say it's Tightrope, but I'm not sure if it was Tightrope or not.
I don't think it's Tightrope. I don't know.
It's one of them. It's probably like Absolute Total Power. I don't know. Absolute Power's a movie he was in. It wasn't that one. Although, was that a Warner's film? I'm not sure.
That was a Columbia picture. Yep.
But then like through the 80s, and this is kind of where I came online as a movie viewer, and I'd say probably the first time I really got heavily exposed to Warner Brothers was every time I'd be watching one of those Police Academy movies, seeing the Warner Brothers logo there. Police Academy movies, Lethal Weapon films, anything that's got a person in tights. So put Christopher Reeve up on screen with the big S on his chest, and that's a Warner Brothers picture. Love that. Sure. Some of the films that we watched a lot when I was a kid in the household was the On Moonlight Bay and By the Light of the Silvery Moon, which were both sort of two early 50s. Do you know these films? They're Doris Day pictures.
Yeah, absolutely.
You didn't think I'd be going there, did you? Going from Police Academy to Doris Day pictures.
I didn't expect you to be going this long either. So that's okay.
No, nor did I. But like when you watch if you watch either of those films, they're very much like TV shows. Like it's very much about just the zany adventures of these characters with short little vignettes that seem to last for about 5 minutes and then move on to the next vignette. It was the kind of thing that existed sort of pre-television really becoming a thing. And that's me kind of speaks to that Warner Brothers ethos, which is it's kind of entertainment for the people. And I just kind of like that all the way through. Do you want to do some movies and then we'll start talking about some of the TV shows as well?
Okay, so Warner Brothers, and I'm so excited that this came up because Warner Brothers has always been my favorite studio for the for several of the points you mentioned, they do, they came from a background of making movies for the mass population, but they also did it with challenging stories and with films that, and Martin Scorsese points this out in the documentary, they embraced prostitution, they embraced domestic violence, they embraced all these elements that people were familiar with during the mid-century and the first part of the mid-century, and film out of that came films like The Maltese Falcon, like Dial M for Murder, and then, you know, a series of films, the great James Cagney gangster movies as well. So they made heroes out of bad people, and they weren't afraid to do that, and that's the sort of cutting edge ethos that Warners have got by on. I fell in love with movies by watching the great Hollywood movies of the 70s, and a huge chunk of those movies were Warner Brothers films. All the President's Men, which you mentioned, The Exorcist, Dog Day Afternoon, Mean Streets, Deliverance. These were all Warner Brothers pictures that all came on the back of the success of Bonnie and Clyde in the 60s. That was a film that Warner's weren't quite sure what to do with, but certainly got behind it when the critics started getting behind it. It also led to films like The Matrix, and the straight line that goes there is that they gave these two young directors carte blanche to do whatever they wanted to do on the streets of Sydney, and what was created was a groundbreaking piece of mass entertainment, and that sums up what Warner Brothers do so well. When I was soaking up as much film culture as I possibly could, I had a disposable income, I had my own wheels, I was going to every movie that I could possibly see, was in the 80s. And Gremlins, The Goonies, Beetlejuice, Blade Runner, The Witches of Eastwick, these were sort of movies that really defined what Warner Brothers was so good at and still do so well.
Was one of those movies from the 1980s, the 1984 Clint Eastwood movie, Tightrope?
You got a real thing for Tightrope. You keep bringing that up in this podcast. I don't think I've ever seen Tightrope. It was widely dismissed and unwatched back in the day.
I kind of like it. I saw it a couple of months ago. And
That explains it.
I can certainly understand why back in the day people would not have really appreciated it very much. And I'm not saying the film's anything like A Fine Wine by any means. But certainly when you're looking for a bit of a throwback sort of early 1980s, just a bit of popcorn, you know, it ticks a lot of boxes these days.
You know, it's interesting because that wasn't a Dirty Harry film, but it sort of spoke of the Dirty Harry Clint Eastwood era. Even when America was coming out of the 60s and everything was counterculture and films like All the President's Men were sticking it to the man and Dog Day Afternoon was sticking it to the man, Warner still had the balls to make Dirty Harry, which was a vigilante cop story which put a big gun in a bad policeman's hand and still made him the hero. So they were still talking to all elements of the population, understanding all sections of their audience. And that's a big deal. That's how... the Warner Brothers ethos, and of course by then the original Warner Brothers were well gone, but the studio system still held them aloft. And you look at those films of the 80s that I listed. I mean, Lethal Weapon is a shoot 'em up cops and robbers movie, but it features a lead performance by Mel Gibson in which he plays a really damaged, dark. You don't see too many Hollywood movies where the hero puts a gun in his mouth and threatens to kill himself because he's a widower, and then turns it into a deeper, darker action film. So, and The Witches of Eastwick was the same. It sort of looked at sexuality and spirituality all within the same story. It's still George Miller's best film. I go on record saying that. Same with Gremlins. Gremlins was a dark fairy tale. So Warner Brothers for me is a real big deal. Caddyshack, I throw in there. JFK, I throw in there. 42nd Street is my favorite musical, all of which come from the Warner Studios.
Yeah. There's obviously Warner Brothers aren't just feature films. There's also animation. Starting out as theatrical animation, you got the Looney Tunes cartoons from back in the day. I don't think I'd really be sort of off base in saying that I think most people's favorite animated shows from being kids are Looney Tunes cartoons.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. like just.
And maybe that's why we have such an affinity to Warner. That's maybe why we have such an affinity to the Warner Brothers logos, because we knew it all. We knew that logo from our very youngest years, and maybe and oh god, the, some of the laughs I've had watching Daffy Duck and Bugs and all that sort of stuff. It was deeply influential.
Look, absolutely. One of the fun things in that first hour of that documentary is when they start talking about the Looney Tunes cartoons, and we're talking about like just the production values of the operatic music that was sort of in there and some of the high level jokes taking place sort of within the music that you wouldn't really expect from a animated short like that. But yeah, I think Looney Tunes obviously.
So tell us about the TV side of things.
Well, this is what I was going to head into.
What's going on with the TV side of things?
Well, this is the thing. So as a kid, like I really feel that a lot of my Warner Brothers engagement went from watching things like Looney Tunes cartoons to I'm of a very specific age where as I was turning, we'll say like about 10 years old, is when Warner Brothers started investing in the early 90s rejuvenation of that Looney Tunes ethos through their animated series. So they started first with Tiny Toons. Sure. Which had Babs and Buster Bunny. That was the first one of these things that came along. But shortly after that, they had Animaniacs, which starred the Warner Brothers and their sister Dot. They had Pinky and the Brain. They had Freakazoid. This also gave way to the launch of the Batman animated series. There was obviously the Superman cartoon that came shortly after that, Justice League. You've just got like this amazing sort of run of animation that kind of came along just as I was kind of, you know, still young enough to sort of really appreciate a lot of that. In terms of live action TV shows, thinking about my own experience sort of from, you know, roughly that age, Dukes of Hazzard was one of the first things I really remember watching as a kid. That was a Warner Brothers TV program. But then that leads into shows like the live action Flash TV series, the first one, and I guess also the recent one. There was that, there was Lois and Clark, leading into things like The West Wing. There's a whole bunch of like one and done series that tends to be played here at like about 11 o'clock at night. There was one show, I'm trying to think of the name of it. It was a courtroom drama that was also created by Lois and Clark's creator, Deborah Joy Levine, that I can't think of the name of, but I'm pretty sure that was a Warner's TV program. Gilmore Girls, oh gosh, what else? So many TV
ER was all Warner Brothers.
Yeah. ER throughout the 90s, there was a bunch of really high profile things. So like ER and Friends are probably the two biggest Warner programs from throughout that 90s. But then also there was the things like Suddenly Susan, for example, was a Warner Brothers series. Veronica's Closet. So a lot of those NBC Friends sort of inspired sort of ripoff shows very much came through that relationship between the network and the studio. What else do you have from around there? Sorry, I'm just picking out a few things. Mad TV, the Drew Carey show is something which I've watched way too many hours of in my life, and largely that show still holds up pretty well. What else have we got around here?
And Warner's were very,
sorry.
Early on, they did the Wonder Woman series with Linda Carter. They were one of the first to sort of bring the or rejuvenate the superhero format for primetime television. So, you know, there'd be no ongoing joy for the Wonder Woman brand without that series. So Warner Brothers were revolutionary in that regard.
Oh, look, absolutely. Also, I mean, just a whole bunch of sitcoms throughout the years as well. Like Murphy Brown, for example, was like a Warner Brothers show. Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, I'm pretty sure, was a Warner show. Head of the Class, Growing Pains. One of the fun things with Growing Pains is if you ever do the Warner Brothers studio tour, which I strongly recommend if anyone's in LA, do that Warner Brothers studio tour because it's just incredible. You can go from the Gilmore Girls house to step out on the street. And as you go up the street, you pass the house from Gremlins. So if you remember the old lady who was, you know, like the cranky lady at the bank, and she gets flung out through the front window of her home by one of those rascally Gremlins. That house that she gets flung out of isn't just the Gremlins house. It's also the Growing Pains house. So you've got that. If you go to the side of that set, the actual side of it is the outdoor set from the Drew Carey show where they go outside to play pool on the pool table out in the backyard.
Nothing goes to waste in Hollywood. Well, that's not entirely true.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, this is a really fascinating documentary series. It starts on Foxtel on Sunday night at 8:30 on Fox Docos and On Demand, or it's on the Max channel if you can get your overseas channels as well. The four episodes are called The Stuff That Dreams Are Made Of. That's the one we've been referencing here in this chat. That then goes to Clint, Kubrick and Kryptonite, which talks about the period of upheaval in the 60s and 70s when a new CEO comes on board at Warner's. There's Hero, Villains and Friends is the third episode where they talk about the 80s and the blockbuster era sort of taking hold. And then most recently they talk of the fourth episode is called Wizarding World and the Big Bang, which of course references the Big Bang Theory and one Harry Potter, which has been arguably their most successful franchise all these years. So I'm glad they made it. Good. That was another Cannes premiere, wasn't it? They showed the couple of the episodes of that at Cannes as well, which makes a lot more sense than The Idol, I must say.
Look, absolutely.
All right, let's get on. Let's head towards quickly, Dan. What else have you been watching?
What else have I been watching? I finally got around to watching Megan, being the horror film.
The dancing doll.
It was a bit weird. It wasn't really the sort of film I was expecting. So, I mean, it was certainly a dancing doll movie where people got brutally murdered. I watched the unrated version as well, which,
I don't know.
Yeah, it was a bit bloody, I guess.
Sounds unpleasant.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought that I thought the movie was very much going to be about a young girl who just received one of these dolls, which, you know, was just like a mass market thing. But I didn't realize it was really I didn't realize it was going to be about the company that was designing the toys. And so it was really quite different and, yeah, very different movie than I expected. Pretty fun. I liked it.
Yeah, not unlikable. It was good fun.
Yeah.
I got around, thanks for asking, what else have I been watching? Well, who knows? I got around to watching two of the more high-profile Australian TV shows this week. Just quickly, Mark Fennell, your friend and mine, he has got a new show out on SBS On Demand called The Kingdom, which talks at length about his experiences within the Hillsong Church. It's a very compelling, strangely entertaining, I guess you could say, story about everything that's gone on at the Hillsong Church. I'd also watched The Secrets of Hillsong, which is a documentary that is available on Hulu and I think on Disney Plus here in Australia. So I'm kind of all Hillsonged out at this stage, but just what goes on there is still a fascinating insight into religion as capitalism. And I also watched Utopia on ABC iView, which is the reworking of the Rob Sitch working dog satire about the small government bureaucracies and all the madness that goes on there. Absolutely nothing has changed on that show between when it last aired and this episode. It looks exactly the same. Writing is still sharp. Material is still obviously rich for the picking with the madness that is local government or any form of government, really. And they nail it. So Utopia offered a few big laughs in that opening episode.
Don't care for that program. Let's go on.
Not a fan? You didn't like the original?
Well, no. My problem with that program is that the entire show is predicated on the idea that Rob Sitch, who is the manager of this department and the one person that can actually affect change there, is just like, oh my God, these people are so wacky. He's the person in charge. He can actually change the entire work culture, but doesn't. The premise of the series is nonsense.
You make a valid point. This day in history, Dan Barrett, I'm going to test you with these. June 11, 1982. Who phoned home for the first time on this day?
Oh, geez. Is this a game for simpletons? Obviously, this is E.T., the extraterrestrial.
And then 11 years later, on June 11, 1993, nature found a way to hurtle which film to a record-breaking $502 million opening weekend?
Look, as I struggle to come up with the answer to this one, I'm just going to give you a little bit of trivia about E.T. E.T., apparently the first movie I ever went to the cinema to go and see. I've been interrogating. Yeah, well, this is what I'm told. So the lore in my family has it that they took me along to see that. It was my first movie in the cinema. And apparently I started crying really excessively during like the emotional sort of E.T., you know, possible death sort of sequence towards the end of the movie, and embarrassed my uncle deeply by the whole experience. I don't know.
Yeah, but you were like that when you sort of spiraled together as well.
Yeah, a little bit. I don't actually remember that. Like, I mean, I remember Spiral really well, which as we all know is from the Book of Saw. What a Book of Saw is, I still don't know. But I don't actually remember seeing E.T., and I've been trying to remember what the first movie is I remember seeing at the cinema. Okay. And I remember seeing a lot of movies at the drive-in when I was a bit younger, but yes. I don't really, I'm trying to work out what the Which first film is that Brisbane? I have. No, this is in my life before Brisbane.
Oh, okay.
Enigmatic. But yeah, I was trying to work out what the first film was. And I think the first film I remember seeing at the cinema was the 1989 Batman movie. And I know it wasn't the first film I'd seen in the cinema because I don't remember it being an unusual experience when I went to see that movie, but it is the first one I remember.
My earliest memory of going to see a film was at the North Ryde Drive-In, and my mum and dad took us to see Disney's Peter Pan. That's probably the very earliest memory I have of going out to see a movie. Yeah, I don't know. And I've got memories of seeing Star Wars and Close Encounters, and I would have been 10 or 11 years old then. So, okay, yeah, good memories. Ah, yeah. Two old men walking down memory lane on a podcast.
Sorry, and so answer your question.
So course, you don't know this one, 11 years later.
Yeah, you're talking about the film Jurassic
so
Park.
So nature found finds a way. Yeah, it's just Jurassic well Park. Done. Yeah. Okay, June, this one might stump you, Mr. TV. June 12, 2009. What happens to all American television broadcasts? June 12, 2009. What happens to all American television broadcasts?
Oh, I mean, I've got an answer to this. I don't know if it really fits with the way the question's sort of phrased, but I'd say they all went digital would be.
I'll pay that. Yeah. It switched from analog NTSC, which stands for National Television Standards Committee, to digital ATSC, which stands for Advanced Television Systems Committee. And that all happened on that day in 2009. That's exciting, isn't it? And then very quickly, June 14, 1989, who slapped a Beverly Hills police cop?
Here's the thing. I've watched enough episodes of The Late Show with David Letterman to know that it was one Jar Jar Gabor.
It was indeed Jar Jar Gabor. Well done. 4 for 4. It's birthday time.
No. Not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no. Not happy birthday.
All right. I think this is a tough one. If any clue is going to come out of this, it's going to be with the oldest of the people here. Let's run through them. June 12, 1930, Jim Nabors. Well, golly. Jim Nabors was born. June 12, 1967, meaning she's only a couple of weeks older than me. Frances O'Connor, the lovely Australian actress. June 13, 1981, Chris Evans was born. And June 15, 1969, one Ice Cube was born. Now, what could all those actors, they've all played a certain role, what could they all have in common?
Well, I just presume they all started their career as rappers, but I don't think that's necessarily true in thinking about it.
Jim Nabors, the rapper. I love it.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, we didn't have to spell out the jokes, Simon. I thought it was pretty obvious. Oh, look, I'm not entirely sure. So I was playing along with the theory that they all had a TV series that debuted in 1995, but Jim Nabors didn't have a series in 95, so that didn't really work out.
He was well gone by then.
Yeah.
Given up?
I think he was still alive, but not for much longer.
No, not for a whole lot longer.
Yeah. All right. I'm stumped by it. What have we got?
They have all been in the army. They've all played army roles. Let me run through four. Now, Jim Nabors, of course, was most famous for playing U.S. Marine Corporal Private First Class Gomer Pyle. Frances O'Connor, she played a pharmacist mate, Rita, as a U.S. Navy nurse corps in John Woo's Wind Talkers. Now, this is an interesting one. Chris Evans, he was Private Steve Rogers before he became Captain America. Now, he's given the title of Captain America, but that is not an official rank. I did a bit of research on this. He'd most likely be a lieutenant colonel, perhaps a major, if he'd chosen a lifetime army career instead of being frozen, and he'd be owed about $4 million in back pay by the army, which is pretty incredible.
Simon, he didn't choose to get frozen. He sacrificed himself and found himself frozen.
Yeah, so that all happened. And Ice Cube played Staff Sergeant Chief Elgin in David O. Russell's Iraqi war film Three Kings, opposite one George Clooney. So there we go. That was a tough birthday segment, but still popular with a lot of the people out there.
Well, I was thinking, like, obviously Ice Cube, and you've got Chris Evans, who was frozen in ice. Do we have any sort of ice thing that links both Jim Nabors and Frances O'Connor together?
Frances O'Connor unfroze The kid from The Sixth Sense in AI, like, had a little robot boy in AI. And Jim Nabors, he is in cryogenically frozen, who hopes to be brought back when they find a cure for the underbite. hey, it's late. This is all I've got. You know how what the time is? It's late.
That was good. I think it was a step above what you usually have to offer. I really liked it. I thought.
Get a bit.
Can I just talk about Chris Evans for a moment? He was in a TV series, and I believe this was a Warner Brothers TV program as well. It was a program lasted all of 13 episodes. It's called Opposite Sex. Mm. Now, what I think is particularly notable about it, let me bring it up on my screen here, because it's got a really interesting pedigree. Is that the word we're going to go with? Yeah, we'll go with that.
I didn't know what you're going to say then.
Let me just bring
What's it called? Opposite Sex?
Opposite Sex.
Doesn't have masturbating. We did so much masturbating.
No, it's quite different.
The TVs.
So what the series was, the premise of it was that there is a all-girls school which is opening its doors for the very first time to boys joining this school. So it becomes co-ed for the first time. There's three boys that end going to the school. Okay, and it's about, you know, the crazy shenanigans that take place. It sort of aspires to be like a bit of a Freaks and Geeks level drama, but it's not really quite there. But the cast on it is just like fairly impressive. So in the three boys, you've got Chris Evans, okay, obviously pre-fame.
Yeah.
You got Miley Ventimiglia, who later went on to fame Gilmore Girls and that series where people got old in different time zones. What was that show called? It was very popular. You know that one.
Yeah.
It was that show.
Yeah, I did know that one.
Yeah. Also in it, you've got Allison Mack, who went on to fame both as the star of Smallville and also led the cult in Nexium.
Yes, she was like a sex fiend, wasn't she? She sort of roped in people to the cult for the leader.
Yeah, she was there using her sci-fi.
She's a Nazi, George, a Nazi.
Yeah, exactly. but you've got other people in it. Rena Sofa, who people know by face, if not by name. Gail Salbovis, she's in there. Lindsay McKeon, people absolutely know her by face. Certainly not by name, but she's just
How did this not become... Did this... So this played out. This was a season of, it's got six episodes. Yeah. Okay. All right. So it did sort of go to where?
13 produced, I believe. Oh, sorry, no, 8 episodes, not 13. Hmm. Nobody knows of the show. Okay. Really great premise. The execution of it, not particularly amazing, but I really like the idea of the series and the spirit of intent behind it. And again, it's got this really good TV cast that, Anyway, Opposite Sex. Look it up,
Is that
kids.
Your dog or was that you shaking in your... testicles banging your thigh.
Gosh, it is late at night, isn't it?
Yeah, you're clearly going to have to cut that out. All right, let's go. Let's wrap this thing up, please.
Simon, no edits. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. My name's Dan Barrett. I'm joined here by Simon Foster, foul-mouthed, potty-focused. Jeez, that guy. Simon, I think it's probably important that people know that I've got a newsletter. It's called Always Be Watching. You can subscribe to it at alwaysbewatching.com. Each day I've got the big stories in streaming, TV, and film. And then on Fridays I do the Always Be Streaming newsletter, which is about an hour 40 away from being late. So I probably need to get that done.
You do good work. That's become quite the thing to read for me. I'm on Twitter at Simon R. Foster 1. I'm not really on Twitter that much. Read my words over at screen-space.net. Everything to do with Screen Watching, it's our Facebook page at Screen Watching Podcast. Lots of stuff going up there. Twitter at screen_watching. The Screen Watching YouTube channel, this week I'll be putting up my interview with Remy Grillo, son of actor Frank Gillo and director of some movie that I've got to watch, which is apparently quite good. And you can email us at screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com. All sorts of ways to contact us here at the Screen Watching Podcast with your insight, requests, and commentary. Now, that's improvising.
Next week on the podcast, we'll be reviewing the new movie, The Flash, which I'm very excited
Are you excited?
Because The Flash is one of my all-time favorites. He's one of my all-time favorites. Well, he's one of my all-time favorite characters. Not so much the Barry Allen version of The Flash.
Oh, I don't like calm down.
Through and through, but Like, I'm pretty curious about seeing this movie. I mean, let's rules talk. I don't think it's going to be amazing. There's a lot of talk about this film being incredible, and I don't think it will be that. But I think it's going to be an entertaining bit of cinema. So, you know, certainly curious.
I will be reviewing, and I'm quite excited about this, he says, hurriedly trying to open next week's running sheet. Yes, we're going to look at The Swarm next week, which is the big new, very expensive series out of Germany. It's called The Swarm with Cécile de France out front. And I'll be looking at the new Julia Louis-Dreyfus film, You Hurt My Feelings, that she's made with Nicole Holofcener. See, now she's another one like Kaley Cuoco, who, if we still had movie stars, she would have had her Sleepless in Seattle or you know, her big movie moment, and she might be a big star, but not so much. Okay.
Simon, Julia Louis-Dreyfus has been around since the... She's been around since the early 80s, okay? She had huge amount of time to become a massive movie star. It clearly wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. Well, she went and did that little show that we know her from, and then another little show which also we know her from. I like it. Can you? She was one of the co-stars of Christmas Vacation. She was one of the yuppies next door, wasn't she?
Yeah, but she was also on Saturday Night Live for a season. She was in late 80s sitcoms. You know, she's been around. Yes. I mean, it's not like Seinfeld was even the first time that she worked with Larry David. Like, she's been around.
Oh. All right. Can I go now?
No. Okay, let's leave. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week.